Well, let's pause for a land acknowledgement. We gather on this part of the continent on Treaty One territory and in the homeland of the Métis Nation. And for my part, I am grateful for the welcome and look forward to continuing to learn more and more about both the cost of that welcome and the value of that welcome. I think when we stop to acknowledge that this is our circumstance geographically and culturally, it's a small way that we can help one another to be aware of ongoing issues, that we can continue to keep our awareness of structures and circumstances that are unjust, that need to be made right, that need to be reconciled, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, reconciled, They help to keep those things that people have worked so hard to bring into the public view in our own thinking. And I think that's very important. Let's take a few moments to breathe together. And again, if you're a guest or you're just sort of popping by for the first time to this community, a reminder that this is a regular practice for us as a community, but it is not an obligation. It's not a ritual of passage of some sort or entry in which some, elite people are made welcome and others are not. It's just not that at all. It's just a chance to be still and be centered and to share breath and life together in a conscious way. And so we're going to do that. And if you wish to join in, please do. If you have other things you need to attend to, or this isn't kind of something you're comfortable with, then as with everything else we will do together today, take what resonates for you and do not take the rest. We're going to do four rounds of the practice we've been using the last few weeks, which is in through our noses for a count of four, or whatever fills you up right to the bottom. And I want to encourage you this morning to, if you're able, to sit somewhere comfortable, feet flat on the floor, hands resting on your legs or in your lap so they're relaxed and you're not feeling like you're wondering what to do with them. And when you breathe in, let your tummy pop out. We don't need to look together just now, or sordid, or thin, or some other cultural value. Just fill your whole torso up with the good stuff of life, with the breath of life. And then when you're full, cradle your breath for a count of seven, and then exhale through your mouth with some restriction, so there's some resistance, for a count of eight until you're emptied right out. We wouldn't be the first people to find it valuable to be aware that emptying ourselves makes room to be filled. And if we're coming to be poured into, this is a way of reminding ourselves together that we need to make room to be poured into as well. All right, so four rounds of that. Let's breathe together. And then we will carry on with what we're exploring together this morning. All right, here we go. Peace, everybody. I don't know if this is a good idea or a bad idea, but I do find myself hoping for all of us in a time like that together that that we can feel some of the weight of this season being shared, and know that there are other people in the world that are breathing with us as a community, and that if we have things that we've shared with the community, that those things are in people's minds and hearts and have been taken into their lives in some way as well. To everyone that opened up some of their story and community time, thank you. This is how we stay connected. This is how we imagine, and increasingly, under these circumstances, we have to imagine what one another are experiencing because we're not having shared experiences so much. This is partly how we imagine the lives of the people that we care about. Is by having things shared and then taking them in and carrying them with us. We've probably all heard I know I've talked about it here before. Maybe we've even been formally taught this notion that in public speaking, it's a good idea to warm the crowd up with a joke right off the top. Sometimes when I hear speakers do that, I laugh. I especially like it when they're funny because then I can laugh with them. I was thinking today that maybe I should give that another try. And so earlier this week, as I was preparing, I spent some time working on a joke. This is already not funny, right? If you have to work on a joke. Anyway, so this joke starts out, this joke I was working on starts out. So this German philosopher and this Hebrew anthologist walk into a bar, and so you can hear the ba-ba-tsh, coming. But then, so I get that far. And then in my imagination, what happens next, because I'm making this joke up, this isn't one that I heard and I'm just retelling. What happens next is that the anthologist and the philosopher start to talk with one another. And they both actually care about the world around them. And so it gets pretty serious pretty fast. And they find things to laugh about together because, us humans have some things about us that are truly silly and funny and all of that. But there's no tidy punchline. Like the joke doesn't have that cha-cha at the end. There's no zinger. There's no bumper sticker piece. There's no, if you could see it this way, the complexity that makes us furrow our brow, or at least makes me furrow my brow, and kind of lean in, that the complexity would go away if we could just get the right window on things, and then we'd have the unlined smiles of those whose world is always bright and beautiful. It just doesn't happen in my imagination when I'm trying to, make up the joke. And so I failed. I failed in my attempt to start off funny. I really should probably know better by now, but that little tape loop, that says people are more receptive if you tell them a joke, that's still playing. I can't quite make it be silent, and so, I go back there once in a while. But having failed to be funny, I did not fail to find what felt to me like a gift. The gift that was hiding in that exercise for me turned out to be imagining this conversation between the anthologist and the philosopher. Stephen King, yes, that's Stephen King, Mr. Paranormal, in his book on writing a memoir of the craft, talks about how not to provide backstory for characters when you're writing. And what he does to kind of make his point is he has us imagine a party at which one character walks up to another character and says, "Hello, ex-wife." And so it's like, pow, backstory exposition in one clumsy stroke. Hello, ex-wife. And so that's become kind of a family joke here in our house, where, a few people have read King's book. If we're watching a movie together and some sort of, ham-fisted exposition is happening, somebody in the room is probably gonna say, "Hello, ex-wife," and everybody else is gonna crack up. I suppose I could do something similar with the Hebrew anthologist by just defining anthologist and saying that's who this character is in my imagination, but we would really lose something. It would like be like defining a character by just entirely, not telling us anything else about them except hello, ex-wife. It's pretty one-dimensional, right? So what I want to do is sort of start there, but not stay there. And stay with me because this is going to turn out to be important later, in the scheme of things. So, an anthologist, not an anthropologist or other whatevers, anthologist, by contemporary definition in this part of the world, is someone that collects artistic works of a similar form or subject. So that's an anthologist. So that's a contemporary definition, but as you can probably easily imagine, it seems that people have been collecting things for as long as there have been people and things. So anthologies and anthologists are not new. So when it comes to things like Hebrew proverbs or wisdom sayings, anthologists have been collecting them for so long that we can't even confidently put a date on when that collecting started. And the Hebrew scriptures, what if you grew up around the Christian Bible, would have been called the Old Testament. The Hebrew scriptures have a couple of big chunks of what are called wisdom literature. They're basically big libraries with libraries inside of them, sort of like the stacks or the sections in your public library, history, art, biography, whatever. And so that's kind of what this collection is like. And one of the biggest collections of wisdom stuff in the Hebrew scriptures is the collection that we would commonly just call Proverbs, if we're familiar with that, the way that's laid out. We don't know very much about the anthologists, about the people who did the collecting, but there is one anthologist of those proverbs that we know a little bit about. And since it's the only one that we know anything about, we're going to choose to take this anthologist as typical of anthologists of proverbs this morning. So if that's a little too close to hello, ex-wife, for your sensibilities, I apologize. It's all we've got to work with. So the anthologist that we know something about is called Agur ben Yaka. And we're mostly going to call him Agur for short. His name means something, but not all scholars agree about what the meaning of his name might be. However, it's the only way we have to imagine where he was coming from, what motivated him when he set out to collect proverbs. So most people agree about his first name, Agur, and they agree that that name just means the compiler or the one who first gathered materials together. Sort of like that tradition in Anglo-Saxon or European language history where, you know, you called the person who ground up your grain Miller, and so now they're here and their last name is still Miller. It's kind of dead obvious. Agur is sort of like that. Agur means compiler. All right, great, because he compiled things. Now, the rest of Agur's name gets more complex. That son of Yaka part, it might mean something along the lines of he who is free from sin, or he who understands the signs, or he who understands the alphabet of God, or he who understands the creative letters of the master. If we are looking to think about this collection that we call Proverbs as something that's handed down to us by God, then those are pretty affirming meanings for the name of the anthologist. They sort of bolster that perspective on the sayings themselves. However, that same name, that same chunk of Agur's name, can be understood to mean something like the one who spat out or despised the words of God. Okay, so now Agur is getting to be an interesting character, right? Is Agur a good guy or a bad guy? Is he someone who collects proverbs because he believes that they are wisdom from the mouth of the divine? Or is he someone that collects proverbs so he can say, as he does in some rabbinic commentaries, I can transgress the proverb against marrying many wives without any fear of being misled by them? That's a quote from one of those commentaries. So what's Agur's perspective? What's Agur's motivation? Is it to kind of go, I'm seeking the wisdom of the divine here, or I'm collecting these sayings so I can kind of, you know, live in defiance of them or shrug them off or kind of go, yeah, this one, but not that one, right? If he were Batman, I don't know. If he were Batman, would he be kind of the one-dimensional early cartoon Batman, so crusader against evil, you know? Or would he be the more nuanced sort of Dark Knight Batman, sometimes caped crusader, sometimes masked villain, or maybe both at the same time, kind of a complex character? Well, by now you could be forgiven for thinking that this is spiraling toward nonsense, and here is why I would disagree with you. Or maybe just to keep us in the story, here is why the German philosopher who walked into the bar with the anthologist would disagree with you. So let's meet our philosopher. Let's call him Hans. If you were around last week or you caught the podcast, you might recall us being introduced to Hans Georg Gadamer. Hans is also a bit complex. Hans lived from 1900 to 2002. Yep, 102 years. Now, one of the things that means is that he was already a professor in Germany during World War II. And unlike his mentor, Martin Heidegger, whose name you might recognize if philosophy's been part of your study or thinking or reading, unlike his mentor, Martin Heidegger, he did not join the Nazi Party. In fact, he was quite silent on the topic. He was basically not politically active at all during the Third Reich. However, along with many other educators, he did sign a document called, this is the English version, I won't even attempt the German version, he did sign a document called The Vow of Allegiance of the Professors of the German Universities and High Schools to Adolf Hitler and the National Socialistic State. On the other hand, he reduced his contact with Heidegger during the Nazi years, and he also sheltered Jewish philosopher Jakob Klein for 2 years in the early 1930s. So, he has some complexities of his own to bring to this interaction. Now, as far as the conversation in the bar goes, Hans, ended up asking Augur, as one might, what he did to fill his days. And Augur told him about his passion for collecting and organizing proverbs. And Hans asked, sort of as a good conversationalist might, he wanted to draw this out, so he asked, is there an interesting one that comes readily to mind? And Augur rattled off the proverb that we would now locate at the address, chapter 29, verse 7, in the collection. And translated, that proverb reads something like this. A righteous man knows the rights of the poor. A wicked man does not understand such knowledge. A righteous man knows the rights of the poor. A wicked man does not understand such knowledge. And Hans, who, as the German scholar who gave us the term Horizontverschmelzung, more on that in a bit, Hans knows a fair bit about how much can get lost in translation, so he asks Augur if that particular English translation does justice to the original language of the text. And Augur says, well, not really. Well, Hans asks, what's missing? Well, the thing that really doesn't quite make it through in most translations is that this proverb isn't just talking about some simple equation for right and wrong, in which the morally upright person knows the rights of the poor and the morally bankrupt person doesn't. It's not really what it's trying to get at. It's talking about something systemic. In fact, it's talking about something so formally systematized as to have become part of the legal system. It might be better translated, Augur says, as the right thing to do is to consider the causes for the claims of the poor or the marginalized, and then recognize and support those claims in court, so in the formal systems of the culture. And the alternative, he says, if you were really kind of getting into the language of the original, is that the wrong thing to do is to not to bother to learn about all that, to not bother to gain knowledge or understanding of it. So that little, a wicked man does not understand such knowledge, that's really gives a pretty short shrift to what's going on in the original language of the text. Well, Hans, who was raised a Protestant Christian, finds this fascinating. And he says it sounds like, based on that proverb, doing the right thing would involve not just reading the text and saying it means X, but would require quite a lot of learning from others, which is what his academic work in philosophy has been about. So now Augur is intrigued because it seems like there's an intersection here that's a little bit unexpected, but it's interesting. And so he asks Hans, how might that work? And so Hans lays it down. It's all about Horizontverschmelzung, about the fusion of horizons. Augur says, the what? Tell me more. Tell me more, just a little FYI. Those are three words you should never say to a philosopher unless you have a bunch of free time, like right available right then, you know, because now you're in for it. So they top up their glasses and Hans spells it out. He says, when we set out to learn something from a text, we're going to need to interpret it. In Hans's world, that's called hermeneutics, and it's his jam. So he explains to Augur that he believes that when we interpret a text, we do it from within a particular tradition. That's like our horizon. That's our vantage point, the point of view from which we look at whatever we're interpreting. And we express that horizon through the medium of language, and both the text and the interpreter belong to and participate in history and language. In other words, both the interpreter and the text have horizons of their own, and those horizons are not the same. And yet, because they both belong to language, they have language in common, that's what makes a possible understanding or interpretation possible. Augur settles in, orders another round. Hans doesn't need another round. He's too occupied with his ideas to even notice he still has a drink. So what happens, he says, is that as the interpreter works to understand the text, a common or shared or fused horizon emerges, a kind of particular understanding that could only come out of dialogue between the interpreter and the text. It's not that the interpreter has somehow accessed some kind of objective meaning. It's that they are experiencing an event in which the world opens itself to them, in which their world gets bigger. And the result isn't a last word, it's a next word. It's a deeper understanding of the subject matter. So Auger, whose business has been collecting and cataloging these meaning-laden but sometimes enigmatic texts, wants to know how these ideas might apply to the proverb that he mentioned. "Kind of you to ask," says Hans. Basically, learning happens in dialogue. Now, that can happen between a person and a text, but it can just as well happen between people. So when we have a conversation in which we want to learn something about a source of knowledge other than ourselves, we need to start by taking the claims of that other source of knowledge seriously, whether that's a text making certain claims or statements or a person. We're only really going to relate to that other person to the degree that we share the goal of understanding one another. That's what's going to limit what we get and what we can give. Ultimately, Hans says, what is most important is the give and take of question and answer. That's where the action is. That's where the deeper understanding can emerge. So Auger, who has, you know, been sort of slumping just a little as he tries to absorb all of this and deeply hear this German philosopher, he sits up a little bit straighter because the light's starting to creep past the horizon a little bit here. So he says, so in the proverb that I quoted, the wise person, the person that English translation I used calls righteous, that's the person that takes the time to take seriously the claims of the marginalized person, right? To ask them questions about their experiences and understandings, about their horizon, and then to examine their own horizon with that in mind. Like, am I getting this? Hans says, yeah, that's the gist of it. And in that process, what emerges is not some new objective meaning, but rather this event that I was talking about, this growing understanding in which horizons confuse for both parties and the world of both can expand. So they still both have their unique experiences and perspectives, and this is important, but now they also share a metaphorical horizon. Now they also have a shared viewpoint on something. What kind of fusion happens, what sorts of understandings grow, will depend on the questions asked. We learn different answers when we ask different questions. And this is a really important idea, I think. And at least as far as my lived experience as Tim goes now, not as a character, it's deeply consistent with what Gadamer is talking about here. If no questions are asked, the experience of Horizon Verschmelzung, of fused horizons, won't happen. And people will just keep looking at the world the way that they did. So, just as Hans says Horizon Verschmelzung, the bartender walks by and he overhears and he tells him that if he keeps talking like that, he's going to be asked to leave. Hans doesn't even notice. He's drinking deep from an idea. He is caught up in the experience and he is going too fast to stop. So he says to Auger, in the proverb that you quoted, if no questions are asked, nothing changes in the relationship between the privileged person and the marginalized person. Nothing new gets added to the conversation about the marginalized person's claims. No one steps up with them to join them in defending those claims. No one wades into the systemic part of this with them. And instead of a fusion of horizons, they just remain part of a collection of people with tunnel vision, each continuing to see the world pretty much as they saw it before, and not really all that concerned about, you know, those other folks, because there's no perceived benefit to them in seeking a shared experience or understanding. They haven't even tried to ask or answer maybe the most selfish question, which is, what's in it for me? Because as soon as we ask that question with our head up, we just might see that what's in it for us is, at the very least, an expanded world. Augur says something in return, but we can't quite hear it because the whole scene is fading to black, and that's happening so we can get back to the narrator, which would be me. Listen, these two are going to be at it until last call. I have to get up to work tomorrow, so I'm out of here. Need a ride home? All right, let's leave that little story device right there. I'm not going to provide any exposition. What my hope would be that we can kind of travel with those characters a little bit in our own imagination as we go from here this morning, and we can do some of our own wrestling with what it might mean in our world, in our lives now, here, to be people who seek fused horizons rather than just kind of defending a particular vantage point or particular horizon, you know, that we might seek some horizon Verschmelzung of our own. And in so doing, if we do that, if we ask the kind of questions, have the kind of conversations, do the kind of learning that moves toward that approach to expanding our world being something that happens in dialogue, if we engage with that, I believe, and my experience has been, that what will happen is that our world will expand. And when our worlds expand, one of the things that happens is that more people more people belong in them. I mean, might seem like a silly way to say it, especially if you're coming at this with a conviction that everyone belongs. But that's not the way we experience it, is it? We experience the limitations of that. And for all sorts of reasons, you know, our own traditions, our own education, our own values, our own fears, our own shame, our own commitment to a certain path, our own momentum sometimes, commitments we've already made. Like, it's a huge, big, complex matrix of things that keep us from coming at the new or the next with this open kind of, what might I see here if I just ask some questions and take seriously the claims of the other party in this dialogue, whether that's a text or a person. My hope is that the conversation between Hans and Augur in the bar can help us imagine maybe conversations of our own that we need to have, whether that's with texts. We had quite a conversation a couple of weeks ago in one of our Zoom hangs about what people are reading, about what sorts of texts they're having this kinds of dialogue with. Great stuff to share. Came away from there with, if you wanted to, you could have come away from that Zoom hang with quite a reading list. It's a very thoughtful community when it comes to what people are reading. But we'll find out that our world can expand, whether that's through texts or actual dialogues with other people. And I believe that is how the thing we might call justice or truth expands, so that more and more people, more and more traditions, more and more perspectives are included in that good thing called a just world. And then I'm going to actually leave it there. Hans, Augur, thanks. It's been good to hang. Thanks for letting us eavesdrop on your conversation in the bar. Now, if either of you need a ride home, I've been drinking water because I needed to pay attention, and booze makes me sleepy. So, you know, there we go. I can drive you. But anyway, it's been good to be together.